Rabbi Yehuda Levi's Sefer Kuzari on Tziduk Hadin and Human Suffering. As you may note, the excerpt in front of us is taken from part of a paragraph heading in the third unit of Sefer Kuzari, specifically Unit 3, paragraph heading 11. And what will undoubtedly immediately strike you with respect to the content of the passage before us is, if you have any questions, and we all have questions, Rabbi Yehuda Levi is not coming to answer them. Which is undoubtedly a sobering thought at the outset, but of course, on further reflection, I think it's also a comforting one. Comforting because we all know very well there aren't any answers. And any facile attempt to provide superficial answers will frustrate, irritate, and provide no relief. So of course, inevitably, once I've kind of spilled the beans at the outset and telling you you're not going to find an answer here, you might be wondering why we're going to discuss this. You might even be wondering why he bothered to write this, if not to give us answers. And I think the answer to that question lies not in answers per se, but in the cultivation of a perspective, an attitude. And this attitude is one that inevitably, as attitudes generally are, extends far beyond the specific parameters of the subject under discussion. Indeed, as such, I think it is like so many passages in Sefer HaKuzari, rather emblematic of the breadth of vision of the book's author, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who we should note as at least a parenthetical aside, if not more than a parenthetical aside, was by no means a stranger to suffering. Just consider the circumstances in which Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived. He lived from approximately 1074 to 1141. The dates aren't entirely certain, but those are relatively close to the actual dates. 1074 to 1141. That means that as a young man, although he didn't experience it, as it were, upon his own flesh, he experienced the First Crusade. In Spain, he experienced more directly the turmoil that resulted from internecine strife among various Islamic groups and the ongoing encroachment of the Christians in the conquest of the Iberian Peninsula on manifold planes. When Rabbi Yehuda Halevi named his book, he didn't name it Sefer HaKuzari per se, he named it rather the Book of Responses to Defend the Despised Faith. And you could well imagine the formulation is one that was extremely apropos given the circumstances in which he lived. Without belaboring this point further, because there's much to discuss in the passage in front of us, I'd like to plunge into what he's telling us here. I feel obliged to, at the very least, give you some general background with respect to the passage from which this is excerpted. In Unit 3, paragraph heading 11, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi cultivates a general perspective of the Hasid, the pious man from the perspective of Judaism, and how he relates altogether to God and his life in this world. And it is then in this context that he discusses the manner in which the pious man seeks divinity in every aspect of his life, seeks incessant opportunities to bless God for both the good and what we perceive as the bad. And it is in that context, specifically in speaking of the prayers, the blessings of the pious man, that he tells us the following. Ve'yashev b'libo tziduk hadin. He settles in his heart the affirmation of divine justice. Yishuv sheyehe lo lemagen ulmistov. A settling that is intended to be a shield and a protection. From the afflictions and travails that occur in the world. Now, of course, inevitably we recognize that this isn't going to be either a shield or a protection from the actual afflictions, to which he will undoubtedly be as vulnerable as he would have been previously, as are all of us. But when he speaks then of the shield and protection, we recognize he isn't speaking of any sort of utilitarian, facile protection against suffering, but rather how he will deal with those experiences in his life. And how so indeed? Kshiyityashev b'nafsho tzedek borei ha'olam u'matrifam u'manhigam b'chokhmato. When he settles in his spirit the justice of the creator of all the living and their sustainer and their guide in his wisdom. V'she'eina de'ot masigot perateha. And moreover, apart from God's justice and his sustaining and guiding the world, his unknowability.
I'm sorry, his what?
We don't know. The human mind is incapable of apprehending, as he expresses it, the particulars of that divine wisdom. Aval masigot klaleha. Only in generality. Bema shehen ro'ot mitikun habri'a vahem, uma mehem, uma shekolel mehapliot hanorot al kavanat chacham v'chafetz yodea v'yachol. And what is included in that wisdom from the wondrous governance of God that indicates the intention of one who is wise and capable and knowing and has the wherewithal to apply that will in the goings-on in the world. Ba'asher sam lekaton v'gadol mehem ma shehu tzarich lo nechushim nistarim v'nir'im v'ruchot v'evarim. Inasmuch as God endowed both small and great, all the living, with whatever that particular living thing needs, both the visible and invisible senses, spirits, endowments, organs, the whole gamut of the accoutrements with which every living thing is endowed that enables it to live in the world. V'sam ha'kelim mefikim re'uyim l'aruchot. Endowing the various component parts of each living thing with whatever it needs in order to function as it should. And as such, v'sam latzvoim midat ha'gevura uchlei hadrisa v'hateref. He endowed hyenas with brazenness, the might, and the predatory behavior that enables them to go about their predation. V'sam la'arnevet v'la ayal klei habricha umidat ha'morech. And endowed rabbits and gazelles with the facility to flee and the attribute of timidity, which of course the rabbits and the gazelles need to be endowed. ומי שמחשב בבריאת האיברים ותועלותיהם וערכם מן הרוחות יראה בזה מהצדק והסידור החוכמי. מה שלא ישאיר בליבו ספק בצדק הבורא. And one who considers then these unique endowments with which every living thing is endowed, exactly what it needs to fill its unique niche in the world, will perceive in them justice and wise order that leave no room for doubt as to the justice of the Creator. Now let's consider what he's telling us here. Of course, we very well appreciate that the hyena, like other predators, is endowed with what it needs to prey on other animals. And the rabbit and the gazelle, the facility to flee, but of course at the end of the day, we know they're going to be lunch. And by consequence, while we may be impressed provisionally by the divine wisdom that endows every living thing with what it needs, there is, of course, an inescapable corollary. And he goes on to say, V'im yavo satan ha-machshava l'harot lo ha'avel al ha'arnevet. If the instigation of thought comes to show him the injustice to the rabbit, b'asher hi ma'achal ha-tzvoim. Because, after all, the rabbit becomes the food of the hyenas, v'hazavuv la'akavish, as does the fly for the spider. So, granted, flies may be a lot less cute than rabbits, but the same essential problem exists with respect to the fly and the spider. Why did the spider get to be the predator and the fly ended up being the prey? Same question as, why is the hyena the predator and the rabbit the prey? Yashiv alav hasechel v'yigar bo. The intellect retorts to this instigation and yells at it, saying, Ech ayaches ha'avel el chacham shnitbarer li tzidko v'she'enenu tzarich el ha'avel. How can I attribute injustice to the wise one whose justice has been clarified to me and who has no need for injustice? Now, I have to pause before we consider the continuation of the argument here. Because inevitably, of course, I realize that at this point we've seen enough to be undoubtedly mighty dissatisfied. This is a response. This is going to provide us with satisfaction. Well, I already warned you at the outset. You're not going to find any answers here. And I'll further highlight that by considering what to me is the connotation of that opening line, Yashiv alav hasechel v'yigar bo. The intellect doesn't merely retort, but it yells at this instigating argument, what about the injustice to the rabbit? And if you'll pardon my being picayune here, why yell? Why can't you just respond in reasoned tones? Especially when, after all, this is an internal dialogue. You know, this isn't something that's happening on the outside. Why do you have to yell at yourself? Why can't you just speak softly? And inevitably, my association is, well, consider under what circumstances in a debate one side starts yelling at the other.
When you lose it.
When you haven't anything intelligent to say. When you don't have anything intelligent to say, you start yelling. Now, maybe I'm being a little bit excessively harsh here. But when there really isn't a cogent argument, you attempt to compensate for the lack of cogency by increased volume. And at some plane, I think here, this isn't the only place where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi invokes the symbolism of yelling in an internal dialogue. I think in the other instance, the connotation is similar. Rabbi HaLevi is indeed intimating. This is not going to be an answer that provides intellectual satisfaction. And on some plane, you need to shout down that instigation that says this is unjust. You need to shout it down because you really aren't going to be able to provide any exhaustive, compelling argument that really convinces you that the problem of injustice has magically evaporated. It hasn't. But what is nonetheless the argument? He continues. Ve'ilu haya tzidat ha-tzvoim la'arnevet ve'tzidat ha'akavish la'zavuv b'mikre, were the predation of the hyenas with respect to the rabbits and the predation of the spider with respect to the fly something coincidental, an accident of circumstance, I would feel constrained to regard then everything as an accident of circumstance. After all, I have to be internally consistent, don't I? But I perceive that wise one who guides and is just, who asher sam klei hatzayid la'aryeh, he is the one who endowed the lion with the means of predation, migvura v'yecholet v'shinayim v'tzipornayim, including physical might, the capacity to seize its prey, the teeth, the claws, v'sam ha'akavish nukar l'tachbura v'sam lo ha'ariga levush mibli l'mida, and made the spider recognizable in its capacity to lure its prey, and endowed it with the wherewithal to spin its web without ever having learnt it. Ye'erog hasvachim lazavuv, weaving its gossamer for the fly. V'sam lo chelim ru'yim la'melacha hazot, endowing it with the various tools that are necessary for this craft. V'zimen lo hazavuv limichya ulmazon, and provided the spider with the fly for sustenance for its diet. Kasher zimen la'arbe midgei hayam mazon dagim acherim, just as he prepared for many of the fish of the sea other fish to eat. Ha'omar al ze shehiye ela lechochma she'eneni masiga ve'atzdik mishnikra hatzur tamim pa'olo, shall I then say regarding this anything other than this is wisdom that I do not grasp? And nonetheless, I affirm the justice of he who is called the rock, perfect in his deeds, which, of course, is a reference to God in Shirat HaAzinu. Now, let's consider what Rabbi Dalevi is doing here. Again, I reiterate what he's not doing here. He's not providing an answer. That is, I hope this is clear to everyone. Saying you can't understand is not an answer. But what is it? What is he bidding us to consider? Essentially, what he's bidding us to consider is what I would describe as the broader picture. That is, what he bids us consider is, first of all, consistency. But the consistency in the context of don't fixate on one part of the picture. Now, it's important to stress this point because there are those who might think, and indeed might construe his words to tell us, oh, you have these problems of apparent divine injustice, distract yourself from those problems. Look someplace else. And it is of paramount importance for us to appreciate that that is definitely not what he's doing here. He's not telling us to distract ourselves. He's not telling us, oh, this isn't the problem, just keep on walking. He grants, this is a problem. This is a problem that you're not going to have an adequately cogent response to address, to enable you to speak in measured tones to that instigation of thought. You're going to have to yell it down. But the way that you're yelling is, you're fixating on part of the picture, you need to see the whole picture. That is, not to become desensitized, insensitive with respect to the suffering that you discern in the world, because it's there and it's real. You'll be able to deal with it by becoming more sensitive. We might even say hypersensitive, but with respect to everything, the whole picture, not just part of it. And when you consider that whole picture in all of its manifold myriad ramifications, so indeed, you see the predation of the rabbit by the hyena, and so on and so forth. Innumerable additional instances. And the problem isn't going to go away. The problem is still there. But it becomes, on some plane, a part of a larger picture that you're able to integrate because you see that larger picture. And this, in essence, is his argument from consistency. That is, okay, you want to say, this doesn't make sense, this is unjust. So where is that going to leave you? As there was a very wise American Jewish author in the mid-60s or thereabouts, around a generation or two ago, Milton Steinberg, had a very wise line in this regard, that the believer in God needs to explain the existence of suffering, the existence of evil in the world. The non-believer, on the other hand, has to explain everything else. And again, that doesn't make the question of evil and the question of suffering evaporate, but it does bid us to consider a larger picture of which this is a part. A crucial part. And a part that doesn't go away. But a part that we integrate because we see a larger picture. And because, at the end of the day, when we consider that larger picture, we're forced to choose one of those two alternatives. To be left with this question, why is there what I perceive as evil and suffering in the world? Or that question, why is there a world? And that gives me the fortitude to keep on going, even though the question hasn't evaporated at all. And I continue to live with it. And he continues, Umi shenityashev al nafsho ze, someone for whom this principle has become settled. Ye chmosha omrim al nachum ish gamzo, will be like what The Talmud relates regarding Nachum Ish Gamzo, Kol Asher Timtzeu Tzara Omer Gamzo L'Tova, who upon encountering any travail in life would say, this too is for good. V'yichyeh chayim arivim tamid. Now this expression, v'yichyeh chayim arivim tamid, can undoubtedly be translated in a number of ways. I suspect that a good translation here might be, and will live a palatable life. Always. Palatable in the sense of, I can stomach this. Not that everything is fine and dandy. Indeed, he considers that additional dimension, betakel alav hatzarot, that the travails will be easier to bear, avafshar sheyismach bahem, and it's possible that he will rejoice in them. Rejoicing in them is a tough row to hoe. He may not. That's a possibility. But at the very least, to be able to stomach life, to regard it as palatable, even though he doesn't have all the answers. And how can he possibly get to a level of actually being happy with experiencing such travails? Rabbi Alevi now gives us a list of considerations that further the prospect of being happy under such circumstances. Consider this list carefully, because I have no doubt it's going to ruffle quite a few feathers by the time we get to the end of it. The first point that he makes, fairly straightforward, כשיגיש לאבון שיש עליו, כמי שיפרע חובו והוא שמח במה שהקל מעליו ממנו. To the extent that he senses that he has some iniquity that requires expiation, he can be happy in the same vein that someone who is in debt is happy when he knows that he's paid his debt, and he feels the relief of having paid the debt. He's poorer. He lost a lot of money paying off the debt, but he doesn't have the debt anymore. And there is that element of relief that does indeed engender happiness. Of course, inevitably, you'll undoubtedly ask, yeah, but what if I could have somehow avoided paying off that debt? Why should I feel happy paying off a debt that could have otherwise been avoided? Good question. But nonetheless, he could be happy on that plane. The additional dimension, v'yismach la'sachar v'la'gemul hatzafuilo, he can be happy over the reward and recompense that is vouchsafed for him, where of course, inevitably, you can again ask, but if I didn't need to experience that suffering, I could have sought the reward on a far more palatable plane, as undoubtedly many others are able to live far easier lives and experience reward without the suffering.
Reward meaning the world to come.
No, even in this world. Could also be the world to come. Not necessarily, though. It could also be in this world. And he continues, V'yismach b'ma shu melamed livnei adam mehasevel v'hatzdakat din haboreh. He can also experience happiness by virtue of being cast in the role of teacher, teaching people about suffering and about justifying the judgments of the Creator. In other words, you get a good deal. You're able to do the teaching. And of course, again, one might well ask, that's something that's supposed to engender happiness? And I'm able to teach people about how much suffering I've experienced? I don't think there are too many people who would seek that kind of a niche to be able to fill. And finally, this is the two to four, the last element of the list. V'yismach v'mashiyesh alav bazeh mehashem hatov v'atiferet. And he could also be happy over having thereby, because he's become a world-class expert on dealing with suffering, because he's experienced so much of it, he can be happy over having thereby acquired a good name and glory. Now, I said this was going to ruffle some feathers. By the time you get to the end of this list, you're very veritably agape. This is what he talks about as engendering happiness? That people will say, oh, look at so-and-so, he's a world expert on suffering. We should really respect him. I'd rather not be such an expert and not have to experience all that suffering. What in the world is he getting at by describing this happiness in what seems to be such a cavalier attitude? And I would submit, very much apropos of what we saw in the previous paragraphs, there's nothing cavalier here at all. Rather, what Rabbi Dalevi essentially is saying is, indeed, the first thing that you can acquire from the conviction that there is that greater picture is the level that he associates with Nachum Ish Gamzo, a conviction, even if it remains an uncomprehended conviction, that there is a goodness, there is a goal, there is order, even if it eludes my understanding. Now again, that's intended to make life something that you can stomach. It makes life palatable. It doesn't necessarily engender happiness. How do you get to that level of happiness? In essence, says Rabbi Yalevi, keep on broadening your vision. Where do you seek happiness? All sorts of places. Even places that seem practically trivial. The good name and glory that you get over becoming an expert and teaching people about suffering. That doesn't sound like anything that's really going to engender a lot of happiness, does it? Well, maybe not, but to the extent that you broaden your vision, to the extent that you are prepared to seek some measure of comfort even in places that seem to offer none, to the extent that you open yourself to experiences from that broad vista of life, to that extent, you may even get to that level of happiness. Now he says, may, there's no guarantee. Efshar shi yismach bahem. He may experience happiness. When all said and done, he may experience happiness means he also may not. Again, were Rabbi Yehuda Halevi bent upon an agenda of providing us with some facile, unequivocal, and irreversible gateway to happiness, undoubtedly he would express himself differently. There are no quick fixes. There are no guarantees. And there's no promise of happiness. The extent to which you might get to happiness is a reflection of the extent to which you're attempting to broaden your horizons. And again, not to become insensitive, not to desensitize yourself, but rather to sensitize yourself all the more to everything that's going on around you in life. Even the seemingly trivial peripheries. Therein, you may find that which engenders that feeling of happiness within you. Indeed, that's exactly what it's about. It's not an answer, it's an attitude. That's the crucial perspective that he's engendering here. Right. And ultimately, again, it is to the extent that we broaden our sights that we're able to seek, I wouldn't even say an answer, but a support from all these various additional dimensions of living. Now, of course, you'll note. Sorry?
I'm just wondering, can one think, or should one think, I reached the stage in life which I've begun to look backwards, and there were times in my life which were quite difficult. And certain instances, I could not have become the kind of person that I did had I not experienced what I did. I'm not saying I accept it, but a kobi day shemayim, that perhaps the suffering has to do with fixing up or punishment of some sort.
So those are among the possibilities that Rabbi Yehuda Levi listed here. So, of course, inevitably, then, my response is, could be. On some plane, in as much as there's no way that he, let alone I, could provide any guarantee that that's the case, it remains up to you. Which, of course, is very much about that search for meaning. That is, you consider your broad picture. And to the extent that you have the wherewithal to connect with every element in that vast canvas, you may find the path that leads you to happiness. He's not going to provide it because he can't. He's giving you an attitude, an approach that engenders that settling of the mind. The happiness ultimately is something that remains ambiguous, a possibility, the possibility that needs to be cultivated. Now, of course, you note that everything that he has stated thus far pertains to the individual. And it is on that plane that he continues. Ze batzavot hamiyuchadot bo. This is with respect to travails that are specific to the individuals. That is, the individual experiences them personally. V'chein yase batzavot hakololot kesheyaviru bilbulei hamachashav al libo orech hagalut ufizur ha'uma uma shehigia eleha mehadalut v'hamiyut. But so too he does regarding the travails of the larger group, the travails of history, when the confounding of thought causes to pass upon his heart the length of exile, the scattering of the nation, and the extent to which it has been beset by destitution and diminution. Yitnachem tchila betziduk adin kaasher amarti. The first element of comfort is tziduk adin, affirming divine justice. What does it mean to affirm divine justice? Does it mean, like Iyov's friends purported to console him, where do we ever see that an innocent man suffered misfortune? It must be that you did something wrong and you need to repent. Is that what he means? Decidedly not. I think we've mentioned this previously. The Gemara in Masechet Baba Metzia uses Iyov's friends to exemplify exactly what the Torah forbade in verbally wronging another person. If you see that another person is experiencing travails and you say, well, you must have sinned, that's ona'at dvarim. That is a Torah prohibition on verbally wronging another person. That's clearly not what Rabbi Dalevi means in terms of tziduk adin. Rather, tziduk adin, again, is affirming that there is divine justice, even though I freely concede it remains inscrutable and I don't understand it. But I affirm it nonetheless, because the alternative to affirming it is, again, regarding everything as chance, regarding everything as an enigma. And I prefer to regard evil and suffering as an enigma rather than regarding the world itself as an enigma. So again, the first consolation is tziduk adin. V'achar ken b'nikui avonotav. ובשכר הצפון לעולם הבא ובהידבק בעניין האלוקי בעולם הזה. And beyond that, kind of in recapitulation of what he stated with respect to the individual in the previous passage, the expiation of one's iniquities, the reward that is vouchsafed for the world to come, and not just the world to come, but also being able to be adherent to the divine essence in this world as well. Meaning, this is a principle that is indeed classic Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that if your focus on spirituality is on an otherworldly spirituality, the world to come, then that's tantamount to counterfeit spirituality. We live in this world. We experience this world. And we seek God in this world. And while, again, there is that element of the reward that is vouchsafed for the world to come, it is all the more critical to consider that adherence to the divine essence as manifest in this world. So again, the paradigm he articulated with respect to the suffering of the individual, but the paradigm can be extended to the suffering of the nation. That is, there's a process. It's a process that we don't fathom. It's a process unfolding, just as there's a process that unfolds with respect to the life of the individual. And just as, with respect to the individual, we don't see the end of the picture. We don't even see how the picture will end. But we have that conviction that there is a broader picture in which this suffering is integrated, so too with respect to the nation. But then, what if that too does not suffice? Because with all of the protestations that this is all part of a greater picture and we don't see the end of it, it looks like, and certainly in Rabbi Yehuda Levi's time, it very much looked like they did see the end, because everything was coming to an end. That instigation within brings one to the point of despair in saying, "Be'omro hatichyena ha'atzamot ha'ele." Shall these bones live? Because that's all that's left. L'godol mashen nichadnu migoy v'nishkach zichreinu. To the extent that we have been erased as a nation and our very memory is forgotten. Uchema she'ne'emar yavshu atzmotenu ve'avdati kvatenu nigzarnu lano. As indeed expressed in our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, we are doomed. And of course, inevitably we recognize, I can't help but note this parenthetically, that there is, of course, a palpable irony in Rabbi Yehuda Levi expressing this argument by quoting the verse from Yechezkel. Because indeed, the Jews in Babel during the Babylonian exile were convinced, our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, we are doomed. But we're still here reading these words. So clearly they were wrong. And even in the time of Rabbi Yehuda Levi, with all of the travails that he experienced personally and that Am Yisrael was subjected to in his time, there's a certain element of chizuk, of encouragement, of reinforcement, that comes just from considering that the Jews in Babylon saw themselves as doomed, and were still around after all those years, and they weren't doomed. So when one is brought to that brink of despair, he has the following prescription. First of all, Yachashov be'echut yitziat Mitzrayim. One should think of the exodus from Egypt. Why the exodus from Egypt? Well, of course, first of all, because it was the first redemption from subjugation, but moreover because there too there was that conviction that all hope was lost. As perhaps most aptly expressed, we all know the Gemara, Midrash, about Amram separating himself from Yocheved because there's no point in having children and bringing another generation into the world just to have them thrown into the Nile. That feeling that all is lost, but all was not lost. And not just recalling Yitziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, but also V'chol ma she'ne'emar b'chama ma'alot tovot la'makom aleinu. Everything that is listed in the poem, Kama ma'alot tovot la'makom aleinu. I hope everyone recognizes what that poem is. We recited it just a couple of weeks ago. In the Seder. Dayenu, right. That is, of course, we should stress the point because I suspect that in imprecisely or perhaps excessively literally translating Dayenu, people miss the point of what we're saying there. That is, do we really mean to say it would be enough if God would have brought us to, say, Mount Sinai without giving us the Torah? We wouldn't have minded not having gotten the Torah?
We wouldn't have known anybody.
Yeah, but to say that would have been enough for us? How would have been enough for us? But while there are a lot of drashot, a lot of expositions to answer that question, there's only one that to my mind is the simple pshat, the simple plain meaning of the text. Namely, it would have been enough for us to have a debt of gratitude. It would have been enough of a reason for us to feel grateful. We wouldn't have gotten to what we wanted. But because I haven't gotten everything that I want, therefore I don't have to say thank you. That debt of gratitude is something that permeates all of life. And you go through that list, and every single element on that list, however seemingly inconsequential, every single element on that list is one that should occasion our thanks. And perhaps, if I can venture a tentative proposal here, the only time in the entire year that we include Hallel HaGadol in Hallel. When I say Hallel HaGadol, of course, I mean the Mizmor, Psalm 136, that lists all of the things that end with the words Ki Le'olam Chasdo, God's kindness is forever. The only time we include it in Hallel is the Hallel that we say at the night of the Seder. Because, you know, there too, we have this whole long list of things, and you wonder, do we really need to have that refrain of Ki Le'olam Chasdo every single time? But the mission, especially at the Seder, is to consider this message, that we need to feel gratitude for every step along the way, even the steps that seem to us to be darkness rather than light. Which is why, as we've discussed in other contexts, at the Seder, you need to start with the gnut, with the negative, before you get to the positive. To consider the gratitude that is engendered by every single step along the way. And therefore, it is this list of Kama Ma'alot Tovot L'Makom Aleinu that focuses our attention, not just on the big picture, but on every single thing in that picture, that sensitizes us, not desensitizes us. That sensitizes us to everything. We don't fixate on anything, because when you fixate on one part of the picture, inevitably you lose sight of the whole picture. But rather, to really integrate into your worldview every iota, every detail of that picture. When you do that, Lo yihye kasher ve'einav ech nashuv lekad mutenu afilu im lo yishael mimenu ela echad. It won't seem too difficult in his eyes how we can be restored to our former grandeur even if only one of us is left. Uchmo she'amar al tir'i tola'at Yaakov. As expressed in Yeshayahu, fear not, worm of Yaakov. An interesting metaphor that Rabbi Yehuda Levi takes almost literally. Ki mahu hanishar min ha'adam kesheshav tola'at bekivro. What is left of a man once he has been reduced to a worm of decay in the grave? And even if that's all that's left, it's enough. Now, again, I feel compelled to reiterate the point with which we began. So what's the answer that is emergent from what Rabbi Dalevi has written here? Answer? There's no answer, exactly. And I hope at this point you can appreciate perhaps more why that is, I think, the most comforting statement that could possibly be offered on this subject. There are no facile answers. And of course, simultaneously, that also means don't start kicking yourself because you haven't subscribed to any of the facile answers that everyone else outside likes to give. You haven't subscribed to them because they don't work. There are no answers. But there is an attitude that enables us to weather the storm in the absence of the answer. To recognize that, indeed, there is an answer even though it continues to elude us. But we don't need the answer in order to keep on going. We need the attitude in order to keep on going. We need the big picture in order to keep on going. In short, what we need is, with every fiber of our being, to continue to experience God in our lives. Does that explain anything? Rabbi Dalevi isn't offering us one word of explanation. But it enables us to keep on going. It makes life, again, palatable. And it provides, at the very least, then, the scaffolding, the basis to keep on building, to keep on growing, to keep on going with a conviction that someplace, not here and not now, our conviction will be vindicated. May God provide us not with the answers here now, because that's not going to happen, but with the fortitude to keep on going in their absence. Amen.